Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jonathan Curiel, journalist at the San Francisco Chronicle and author of All America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Thomas Ricks, military correspondent at the Washington Post, senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, author of Fiasco and The Gamble, General Petraeus and the American Military Gamble in Iraq, 2006 to 2008. Mr. Ricks has covered the Pentagon for more than 25 years, first with the Wall Street Journal and now with the Washington Post. He's covered U.S. military actions in Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Mr. Ricks has received two Pulitzer Prizes. In 2000, he and a team of Wall Street Journal reporters received the Pulitzer Prize for their look at how the military should respond to the changing demands of the 21st century. And then in 2002, he was part of a team at the Post honored for reports on the beginning of U.S. counterterrorism efforts. His first book on Iraq, Fiasco, caused a stir and became a New York Times bestseller. His latest book, The Gamble, is a continuation of analysis of the war in Iraq. It is currently number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Please welcome Thomas Ricks.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here tonight. Can you all hear me in the cheap seats? Okay, good. You didn't pay enough. That's the problem. I want to begin with a salute and a question. The salute is to Lieutenant Colonel Terry Daley, one of the great American heroes of counterinsurgency, who actually is responsible for a lot of people in this book figuring out how to do better in Iraq. It was Terry's incessant pounding on people, you need to think about fighting this war differently, that really pushed a lot of generals in the right direction. So he really has contributed to his country. Another group of people who have contributed to the country are people who have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last few years. I wanted to ask, is there anybody here who is a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan? I just want to say thank you very much for your service. And welcome home, and I hope you enjoy our country. I want to talk tonight about three things about the war in Iraq that people back home don't understand. The first is how hard the surge was, how difficult, especially the spring of 2007 was for those who were there. The second is that the surge failed. It succeeded militarily, it improved security, but it didn't achieve the goals laid out for it by the President and the Secretary of Defense. And the third thing I think people back here don't understand is that this war is not over. In fact, I think it may be just halfway through. Indeed, Obama's war in Iraq may be longer than Bush's war. Those are the three things I want to discuss, and then I want to get as quickly as possible to your questions, because I think that's always the more interesting part of an event like this. First, how tough the surge was. So this is a major theme of the first half of the book. People here didn't understand, I think, or if they did, have forgotten, that this was probably the six toughest months of fighting that we've seen in this war so far. In the spring of 2007, U.S. forces went for months taking increasing casualties with no sign of the new strategy having any positive effect. There were 70 killed in action in February 2007, 71 KIA in March, 96 KIA in April, 120 in May. Soldiers had to fight their way into neighborhoods. The new theory, and this is the most important aspect of the surge, was no longer was the top priority for Americans to transition to Iraqi control, to pass the ball to Iraqi security forces. The new goal was protect the Iraqi population, which, as Lieutenant Colonel Daley will tell you, is the key to any successful counterinsurgency. Get out there and protect the population. In order to do that, you must be among the people. You can't be a war tourist, as one person called it, living in a big forward operating base, going out into neighborhoods on patrol for 1 hour a day, and then going back to your base. Because guess what? Someone else controls the neighborhood for the other 23 hours, most likely not an ally of yours. And that other person, an enemy, a bandit, a faction, a leader, will intimidate anybody who does cooperate with you. What's more, you have no idea what looks right in the neighborhood, what looks normal, and what looks abnormal if you're not there. So the surge, the key aspect of the surge was not let's send more troops out. The key aspect was protect the people. If you're going to protect the people, you must be among them. That takes a lot of troops. So, okay, we need more troops. That's how the thinking went. But it wasn't easy. One unit I know of encountered 50 bombs on its way to the new outpost it was establishing. Another unit I know was engaged in a firefight on the way to its outpost that it was trying to set up. And it was a fascinating moment because in the middle of the firefight, the platoon sergeant saw two Iraqi kids frozen with fear standing in the middle of the street, jumped up, put one kid under each arm, and rolled to a corner. And another soldier said later, that's the moment we won that firefight. It wasn't that we killed the insurgents. We made them irrelevant. We showed we were there to really protect the people. We were not making promises because no Iraqi were going to believe any more American promises. They'd heard them for years. All we could do was show them. And they, people in that neighborhood saw the sergeant risk his life to protect Iraqi kids. Suddenly, there was a new sheriff acting differently in town. The only section I'm going to impose on you with tonight in reading from my book is a section called The Hardest Step about this time. Moving American soldiers from big isolated bases and into new posts of 35 or 100 soldiers located in vacant schoolhouses, factories, and apartment buildings in Baghdad's neighborhoods was the hardest step. Essentially, U.S. forces were sallying out to launch a counteroffensive to retake the city. The first few days were surprisingly violent, with an average of almost 180 attacks a day on U.S. forces. That was the Battle of Baghdad, Petraeus said, looking back 18 months later. It was just very, very difficult, very, very hard. During February 2007, Baghdad suffered an average of more than one car bomb attack a day. Between late January and late February, at least eight U.S. helicopters were shot down. In March, the 2nd Surge Unit, the 4th Brigade of the 1st Infantry Division, began operations in western Baghdad. One skeptical soldier from the Big Red One told a reporter that he didn't expect the new approach to work. "It's getting worse and worse," he said. "They don't even respect us anymore. They spit at us. They throw rocks at us. It wasn't like that before." In some Shiite neighborhoods, units were greeted by stacked loudspeakers, blaring the chants of the Jaish al-Mahdi, the militia of the radical Shiite leader Muqtadir al-Sadr. In Sunni neighborhoods that had been ethnically cleansed, patrolling soldiers often found piles of executed bodies in vacant houses with blood smeared on the walls. This is how the operations officer for a battalion operating in southwest Baghdad recalled that time to a researcher for the official Center for Army Lessons Learned. "When we first moved into the AO, that's the area of operations, it was house-to-house clearing and fighting most of the way. It took months before we could drive more than halfway north through the Malhallas, that means the neighborhoods, without hitting multiple IEDs and taking fire. The first task was simply surviving. Our first 2 weeks were tough," Lieutenant Jacob Carlisle, a platoon leader, later said. "We had to clear every day, and we got hit every day. Indeed, in June, he was shot in the thigh and hit by shrapnel in the face and arm." When Baker Company, a unit in the 2nd Infantry Division, moved into the tough neighborhood of Dora in southern Baghdad, it was greeted with constant enemy small arms fire, IED, RPG, and grenade attacks, often surprisingly coordinated, recalled Lieutenant Tim Gross, a platoon leader. "Baker Company began its time there by spending 3 nights using shovels, screwdrivers, and tire irons to remove 18 deep-buried bombs in its area. A deep-buried bomb is a bomb that is down deep, but is so large it can blow an armored vehicle like a tank into the air. They began with almost no information from the people of the area, who had felt abused by Iraqi officials operating there. Indeed, Baker Company later would ban from its area the most abusive of the police, the militia-infested National Police. Finally, in talking about this period, I think of the Battle of Taormina. And this is one of the striking aspects to me. When I wrote Fiasco, I kind of knew what the events that I wanted to write about were. The invasion, first Fallujah, second Fallujah, Abu Ghraib. But I was going to place them in context and give them meaning. When I wrote this book, I honestly didn't know what events would be significant, partly because I began researching it as these events began, but also because I think the media kind of never got a hold of this last couple of years of the war, never had a feel for it. For years, the media had been out of head of the government and the military in understanding what was happening in Iraq. But with the invasion, with the surge, most of the media didn't understand counterinsurgency. All they could say was, well, more American troops are dying, it must not be working. They really didn't have a feel for the different narrative that was emerging. So, for example, the Battle of Taormina. There's a platoon-sized outpost, 38 men, in Taormina, a little town on the Tigris River north of Baghdad. One morning at 7 a.m., they're hit by a rocket-propelled grenade and then very quickly a truck bomb at the front. The bomb is so large that it's heard by soldiers 7 miles away. They are subjected to intense attack. They hold the post. At the end of the day, of the 38 soldiers there, 29 are wounded and 2 are dead. But they held the post. The key aspect of this was holding the post. Petraeus and Odierno, the two commanders, had vowed, we will not give up ground. Once you go into an area, you must stay there, because to do otherwise is to betray the locals who come to your aid. And these guys held it and were very proud of the fact, and I think they really deserve credit for it. A second misunderstood aspect of the surge was just who was running it, who these people were. And I think the key to understanding this is to understand that in January 2007, the Bush administration in Iraq began the transition to Obama. What do I mean by that? In January 2007, President Bush turned the war over to the dissidents, over to the critics of the war. Ambassador Ryan Crocker, our top diplomat out there for the last couple of years, reveals in the book that he essentially opposed the invasion of Iraq. General Petraeus, when he was appointed to the job of top commander in Iraq, had just finished overseeing the writing of a counterinsurgency manual that can be read as a scathing critique of how the Americans had handled the war for several years. These guys were not particularly popular in the Army. General Petraeus is a bit of an outlier himself. He likes politicians, he likes reporters, and he has a PhD from Princeton. In the Army, that's 3 strikes. The people they brought in around them were quite striking. First of all, you have one of the most elite clubs in the world. Petraeus brought in around him as advisors men who had commanded combat brigades and battalions in Iraq, but also had PhDs from elite American institutions. This is a vanishingly small group of people, and he got them all. Pete Mansour, his executive officer, PhD in military history, from Ohio State, one of the best military history departments in the country, also had commanded a brigade of the 1st Armored Division in Baghdad. Colonel H.R. McMaster, head of his strategy plant and planning group, had commanded the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment in Talafar, as people also pronounce it, in northwest Iraq, was one of the heroes of my book, Fiasco, also has a PhD in military history from the University of North Carolina, and author of the very well-regarded book, Dereliction of Duty. Again and again, you'd come across people like this who would mention in the course of hopping out of a Bradley fighting vehicle that they had a PhD in economics from Harvard. Or I remember Susan Nielsen, a lieutenant colonel, oh, yeah, I did my PhD at Harvard. It was interesting to see what people there thought. Oh, you know, as if you'd sort of drop by and pick up the PhD between assignments in Iraq. In fact, one of Petraeus's aides told me one day, she said, you know, I'm probably the only person in the Princeton Political Science Department doing my PhD here in Iraq right now. She was an expert on the Shiite militias. 3 of the most interesting advisors brought in, there were foreigners, and this reflected part of this new atmosphere in Iraq in that period. After 4 years of saying the American way or the highway, the Americans started listening to other people. They started listening to Iraqis. They started listening to foreigners. they started showing a little bit of humility. Maybe we don't have all the answers. And this was most striking in three of the advisors that Petraeus Nerodierno brought in around them. The first one was David Kilcullen, an Australian infantryman turned anthropologist, kind of the Crocodile Dundee of counterinsurgency. The second one was Sadi Othman, a Palestinian-American born in Brazil, raised in Jordan, unusual for a Palestinian 6'7", the first man ever to dunk a basketball in Jordanian university competition. On 9/11 was a taxi driver in New York City, said he felt violated as an American, as a Palestinian, and as an Arab, and decided to do something about it, and got himself a job working as an interpreter for the Americans. One day, he was in northern Iraq in Mosul, and he met this little guy coming out of the latrine wearing gym shorts and a brown shirt. Started talking to him, found the guy kind of interesting, got in a long argument with this guy talking about Iraq and stuff. At the end of the hour, the guy says, "I want you to come work for me." And Othman thought, "Well, who is this little guy? I thought he was a civilian contractor." He said, "No, I'm General Petraeus." And so Petraeus went to work for the little... I mean, Othman went to work for the little guy. And in this most recent period was Petraeus' ambassador to the Iraqi government. I should mention also that Othman was a pacifist, educated in America by Mennonites. The third of the advisors was also a pacifist, and even more unusual. Emma Skye, a small bird-like woman, British, anti-American, anti-military, pacifist, expert in the Middle East, speaker of Hebrew and Arabic, and had read Fiasco, my previous book, one weekend. And you got to remember, in Fiasco, General Odierno is not a hero. In fact, I describe him as one of the generals who embodied the wrong approach, the counterproductive approach of using tactics that inflamed the insurgency. She has just finished reading this book. She gets a phone call from Raymond Odierno. "Hey, Emma, I'd like you to come to Iraq and be my political advisor." Probably the most unusual job interview I've ever heard of. She says, "Okay, General, on one condition, you understand that the first time I see you commit or condone a war crime, I am personally reporting you to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague." Odierno typically said, chuckled and said, "Okay." What he knew and she didn't was that the U.S. military and the U.S. government don't subscribe to the War Crimes Tribunal. But he understood the point she was making. She would go public if she saw things she didn't like. He was willing to take that risk because it was the right thing to do, and these guys were really trying to fight this war differently. Sometimes she became pretty emphatic, though. One day, Petraeus referred to her in a meeting as Odierno's insurgent rather than Odierno's political advisor. The point of this is that 2007 and 2008, talking became as important as fighting. And sometimes you realized you were fighting people and talking to them and then fighting them and talking to them at the same time. This really came home to me with what is, I think, my favorite part of the book, a section called The Insurgent Who Loved Titanic. This involves Captain Sam Cooke, another one of these very interesting characters that bubbled up in the U.S. military. Sam's father was a professor of religion in Northern Ireland, but Sam somehow wound up a captain in the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. He one day, in his little outpost north of Baghdad, heard about an insurgent who was boasting of having planted 200 bombs against the Americans since this insurgent had been radicalized by the Abu Ghraib scandal. 200 bombs. Now, an army captain, a tough, smart army captain like Cooke, a couple of years earlier, would have gotten this information, would have gotten the guy's location, and would have launched a raid to capture or kill him, and then would have been applauded by his superiors for his good work. But Captain Cooke had been around the block a couple of times in Iraq, and a lot of guys had spent a lot of time capturing and killing enemy network leaders and finding it didn't really lead to any downturn in violence. So he did something different, almost un-American. He invited the guy over for tea. The insurgent, curious, a little bit proud, puzzled, showed up and said, "I just want to understand, why aren't you arresting me now that I'm here?" And Cooke said, "That would violate the rules of hospitality. You're my guest. I invited you. I see you on the street tomorrow, I might shoot you. But here you are my guest. Let's talk." And they begin talking. they didn't find any great kumbaya moment of, oh, yeah, democracy's right. What they found was that they're able to talk to each other, that there was a respect for each other that you frequently find, by the way, in frontline soldiers, for enemy soldiers. And they begin talking about how things happen in certain ways and why this guy was radicalized by Abu Ghraib and actually where he got his bomb-making materials. But he continued to insist that America was the devil. Nothing good can come from America, this insurgent said. I hate everything American. Well, Captain Cook had been around Iraq a little, and he knew that the most popular ringtone among Iraqis on their cell phones these days is the theme from the movie Titanic. And he knows that Iraqis love the movie Titanic. And so Cook says, but you've seen Titanic, haven't you? And the surgeon says, yes, of course, 7 times. I cry every time when Leonardo DiCaprio slips into the water. They didn't find that they were buddies. They continued to talk. And in fact, at one point, Cook found out that the insurgent was circulating his photograph in case he had to kill him. Cook, meanwhile, had invited his bodyguards one day to come and take a look at this guy so they could shoot him if they had to. Eventually, after several weeks of talking, the insurgent decided on a reconciliation ceremony. He said, I'm not going to turn myself into you. I need to turn myself into an Iraqi as a matter of self-respect. But I'll bring my network in and we'll have a ceremony, and then you'll put me on the payroll. Because this is what the Americans were doing. They were putting the insurgents on the payroll. And once the guy's on the payroll, they had some very interesting conversations. And this happened again and again around Iraq over the last couple of years. You know why you never caught me? Because every time your guys came into my neighborhood, the Iraqi police at the checkpoint would call me. So you might want to take away the cell phones from the police at the checkpoint. And by the way, when you rousted out my house and got everybody out in the middle of the night, there was always a cow sitting in the backyard. You know why? Because I dug a pit with a trap door on it, and we trained the cow to sit on the trap door. And you Americans are too nice to cows. You wouldn't move it. Another guy was told, you know that sniper rifle you found us with? You know who gave it to us? That Iraqi major you work with. Actually, Cook was told, by the way, you know why the Iraqi police don't fight us? Because we have a ceasefire agreement with them. They said, your fight's with the Americans, not with the police. So we fight you, and the police chief said, we'll stay out of it. Again and again, these conversations took place over the last couple of years. And as Cook said, it was like the lights were turned on. Americans began to understand Iraq finally. Okay, given that, why do I say the surge failed? Because it didn't achieve the goal the President and the Secretary of Defense established for, which was not only to improve security, but to improve security in such a way as to create a breathing space in which a political breakthrough would occur. Well, here we are, the surge is over, and none of the basic problems that vexed Iraq before the surge have been solved, not one. All of them still hanging fire, all of them having provoked violence in the past and still liable to lead to violence. Foremost, how do we share oil revenue among Iraqis? Second, what is ultimately to be the relationship between Kurds, Sunnis, and Shiites? Third, where does power reside inside the Shiite community? Fourth, what is the disposition of the disputed city of Kirkuk? Fifth, what is the role of Iran in Iraq, the big winner in this war so far, by the way? And by the way, I guarantee you that whatever government ultimately emerges in Iraq will be an ally more of Tehran than of Washington. So none of these problems were solved. Where are we now? It is now Obama's war. I think he has inherited the worst foreign policy situation that any new president has ever taken on. And what's really scary about that is it isn't even his number one problem. So I think the first year of Obama's war may be tougher than the last year of Bush's. We have 3 rounds of elections in Iraq scheduled this year, and elections in Iraq tend to be destabilizing. People say to me, what about the provincial elections the other day? Didn't those work out? I said, we'll see. Remember the purple finger elections of a couple of years ago? Remember the ceasefire? I mean, the civil war that followed 6 months later? One thing led to another. The election, original election, intensified sectarian difference. We don't know quite how this is going to shake out. At the end of this year, they have general elections scheduled in Iraq. And that will come just as we are taking down troops. Odierno says in the book that the first troop withdrawals are easy. You take them out of the more secure areas or the areas where Iraqi forces are more reliable. By the end of this year, in early 10, you start taking troops out of areas that are risky, dangerous, or where Iraqi forces are unreliable or positively evil. So the fewer American troops you have there, the less understanding, the less feel you have for the place. This is the reverse surge. An anecdote that really scared me is I heard about a Turkmen police chief who was mad at a Kurdish village and so used his pull, his wasta, with an Iraqi general to have an airstrike arranged against the Kurdish village. The American Apache attack helicopters came in, didn't see the threat described, and declined to fire. What happens a couple of years from now when you don't have as much awareness, when you can't call an American advisor on the ground and say, I don't see the threat, when there's an Iraqi general who says, fire anyway? It reminds me a little bit of Warren Buffett's comment that if you've been playing poker for half an hour and you don't know who the patsy at the table is, you're the patsy. I worry that if we don't have troops on the ground, but we still have firepower being used in Iraq, we become the patsy. So in sum, the war is not over. The war has changed several times and is changing again. It was an invasion. Then it was an inept occupation. Then it was a slow rising but very durable insurgency. Then it was a civil war. Then it was a fairly competent American counterinsurgency offensive. Now it's kind of a lull, I think, as the various players prepare themselves for what they expect will be the post-American environment, how to hold power in Iraq when America has less influence. But I think this thing is far from over. General Odierno says at the end of the book that he would like to see 35,000 troops in Iraq in the year 2015, which would be well into what would be Obama's second term. I think that's a lot more likely to happen than candidate Obama's rather fatuous promise to have all combat troops out of Iraq in 16 months. Newsflash for Obama, there is no such thing as non-combat troops. There's no pacifist wing of the U.S. Marine Corps. All troops are liable to be in combat. In fact, for my own personal safety, I'd much rather be with an infantry foot patrol than a convoy of transport troops. The foot patrol, nobody's going to waste a bomb on four soldiers. Who are spread out. You only might get one or two of them. They're going to use the bomb against the convoy, the truck convoy. So I think we're only halfway through it. This is going to go on a long time, and this is going to be the longest war in American history. And now you can see why John Stewart calls me Little Mr. Sunshine. That takes care of my prepared remarks, and I'd love to get into questions and answers now.
Yeah, our thanks to our thanks to Thomas Ricks for his comments this evening. We have a number of questions, and one of the things I want to bring up from your book, you talk about the year 2015. There were actually generals you spoke with who said the U.S. troops will actually be in Iraq long past that. And in fact, you quote someone as saying U.S. troops can be in Iraq for 50 years.
Now, oh, yeah. That was one, I think it was a sergeant. He said, 5, 10 years? Forget it, 50. Yeah.
Right. So Obama here has a time, you mentioned his timetable for 16 months. I mean, what realistically is the correct timetable for Iraq? We have several people asking about that. And in your book, you talk about a moment that when American troops leave, you know, genocide could even happen, that people are essentially, even Muqtada al-Sadr, are waiting for U.S. troops to leave.
One day in Bakuba, Iraq, an American soldier turned to a former insurgent, one of the Sunni insurgents who was put on the payroll, and he said, he's curious, like a 19-year-old soldier might be. He said, so, do you still want to kill me? And the Iraqi former insurgent said, yes, but not today. Well, that's progress in Iraq. That's kind of the attitude of a lot of Iraqis. Nobody really likes us, and everybody wants us to leave, but nobody wants us to leave right now. We are kind of seen as more trusted than any other player on the battlefield, even though we're disliked, partly because they think eventually we will get out of the way. But they don't want us to leave right now because there is a common view that the Americans have become the glue that's holding this thing together and preventing it from blowing up. That we will prevent the Shiite death squads from attacking Sunni neighborhoods. And we did a good job of stopping the Sunnis from blowing up Shiite mosque and marketplace. How long can you keep that up? My real concern is the American people are just going to say, let's get out of this. My problem with that is this is a mess that largely we created. I actually do not think, and this gets into realms of philosophy well over my head, I don't think there is a moral answer in Iraq. I think all the answers are immoral. I think this is actually the nature of tragedy. Leaving, I think, is immoral. Staying is immoral. It's all fruit of the poison tree. It all stems from the original sin of invading Iraq when we shouldn't have, which is, I think, the biggest mistake in American history. This is actually one reason I came to admire a lot of these people who got involved in Iraq in the last couple of years, the people who had opposed the war, opposed the occupation, or how it was handled, but who said, just because you invade a country stupidly doesn't mean you should leave it stupidly. And if you left right now, yeah, there very well might be a civil war. There very well might be a genocide launched against the Sunnis. If there is such a campaign, Saudi Arabia has already said it will intervene. Other Sunni Arab states, Jordan and Egypt, I think, also would intervene. Turkey has made it clear it will intervene if the Kurds make a bid for an independent Kurdish state. And suddenly you're off to the races of a regional war. The difference between this and Vietnam is we could walk away from Vietnam, and yeah, there was a Holocaust in Cambodia. And yeah, a lot of former American allies spent many years in re-education camps. But for us, it was mourning in America 6 years later. We kind of waltzed away from it. It's not going to be easy. It's so easy to walk away from Iraq. Vietnam was at the periphery of American national interest, ultimately. Iraq is in the middle of the world's oil patch. It is crucial to the world's economy, that region. In retrospect, American foreign policy did a pretty good job for several decades, really since 1954, of having influence in Iraq without getting stuck on the ground. And George W. Bush blew that record.
President Obama has talked about Afghanistan and how that should be more a priority than it is now. And we have three questions from the audience that relate to this idea. One of the questions is, what does the United States learned in Iraq, how does it transfer to Afghanistan? And I know you've written about Afghanistan for Foreign Policy magazine.
And I used to live there.
And you used to live there, exactly. Yeah. Can you talk about the lessons learned that could apply or may not apply to Afghanistan?
Sure. General Petraeus, having finished command in Iraq, was promoted to Central Command, which is the U.S. military headquarters for the region, overseeing both the Iraq war and the Afghan war. So I think what he will bring to Afghanistan is not a menu book, not a recipe like we're going to do X, Y, Z, but an attitude. And this attitude consists of, if you want wars to end, eventually you have to talk to your enemy. I think he'll look to disaggregate the enemy, as he did in Iraq. Find people who have not necessarily going to come over to your side, but can be neutralized. You can find some sort of common interest. This is actually called the law of conservation of enemies. Don't make any more enemies than you need to have at any given time. This was a rule that the Bush administration had a hard time grasping. So I think you'll see him try to cut deals, try to find Taliban chieftains he can kind of take out of the herd. He can say, okay, if we build this road, will you protect the road and not rip off all the truckers who come through like the Afghan police do? If we put a platoon in your neighborhood and protect your local government, will you do X, Y, and Z? And the thousands of little deals will be cut. The problem with this, and I think the Obama people recognize this well, is it's not just a war in Afghanistan. And they talk about now the Afghanistan-Pakistan war, which is a good step because it is a regional war and it must have a regional solution. Not only is it the Afghan-Pakistan war, of those two arenas, Pakistan is the more important one. We could have a mess in Afghanistan. It would be bad, it would be sad, but it wouldn't be a catastrophe for this country. You could have a big mess in Iraq, in Pakistan very quickly, and it would be a real problem for this country. If the Pakistani government collapses, you face the prospect of Islamic extremists and nuclear weapons coming together. That is al-Qaeda's dream. It's our nightmare. I'm not sure there's a good answer in Pakistan. The answer might be something that really is profoundly unsatisfying to can-do Americans. Maybe the best thing you can do is kick the can down the road. Maybe the best thing you can do is help Iraq, help Pakistan stay together while Pakistani solutions emerge, because local solutions ultimately are going to be the sustainable solutions. But what the Obama people have recognized is what actually a friend of mine, Andrew Exum, said in his blog, Abu Mukwama, which is one of my favorite blogs. It's really hard to win a war in Afghanistan when the enemy decides to fight it in Pakistan.
A reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Thomas Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of The Gamble. Today, there was a poll released that talked about how 60% of Americans are optimistic about what's going to happen in Iraq versus 2 years ago when the figure was about 22%. And yet, when you read your book, you really are brought down, back down to earth, as it were, and you see the reality. A question from the audience is you quote Ryan Crocker as saying, the events for which the Iraq war will be remembered have not happened yet. And do you agree, and can you give us your thoughts on this?
I do agree with Crocker, which is why I made it the last line in the book. It was interesting. He actually said this to me first in January 2008. The way I reported this book is I went out to Iraq frequently, and each time I'd see about the same 30 to 50 people, Crocker, Odierno Petraeus, some colonels I knew, brigade-level company commanders, and I'd just sit and talk. And it was all in the understanding that none of this stuff would be published until the end of 2008 or January 2009. So Crocker and I were talking in January 08 one day, and he said that the events for which this war will be remembered have not yet happened. And that really struck me. And so when I saw him again this last time in October, actually in November in Baghdad, I said, look, I'm going to make this the last line of my book if you still think it's true. He said, oh, yeah, absolutely it's true. These events have not yet happened. The things that we're going to come to understand about what this war means, how this war ends, will determine what we think of this war. That's all still in the future. If I could summarize, I think the theme of fiasco was this war is going much worse than you guys think and much worse than the government's telling you. I think the theme of the gamble is this war is not going as well as you think, and we're going to be stuck there a lot longer than anybody in America seems to understand.
Another question from the audience. Didn't the press lead the U.S. public to believe the surge was a big success in the war in Iraq and that it was winding down? And a related question is, here, you're talking about what generals told you kind of off the record, as long as you would hold on to it for a couple years. Did that give you a pause, as it were, and make you feel a bit uneasy in the sense that you wanted to get this information out more quickly than it got out?
I really found the level of discourse on the Iraq war pathetic in the last couple of years. When you see people say, is the surge working? I mean, I'd be watching TV and just rip my hair out. In what sense? What do you mean working? You need to define the terms here. People would say, oh, yeah, the surge is working. It became a White House talking point. The surge is working. Well, in what sense? What's the outcome? What are you trying to do with it? As I said, it's a split decision, and really the best you can give the surge is an incomplete, but I actually think it failed because it's over and didn't do what it was supposed to do. I don't have a problem with doing these two levels of reporting because I was also writing at the same time, and I didn't violate the understanding that this stuff wouldn't be printed. But what it did, because I knew what these guys were thinking privately, it really sharpened my coverage of what they said publicly. So I'd be sitting there, for example, on a congressional hearing, and I knew how concerned Ryan Crocker was about the future of Iraq. And Crocker's an expert on Lebanon. He's lived in Lebanon. In fact, he was blown up in the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon once when about 64 of his colleagues were killed. And so he talked in one of these congressional hearings, the much-watched congressional hearings of the fall of 07 and the spring of 08. He talked about the Lebanization of Iraq as a really likely future scenario. And I knew exactly what he meant. What he meant was in Lebanon, Hezbollah is a power inside the government of Lebanon, but also an armed power outside the government. And that's what he saw was a likely future for some of these armed factions in Iraq. Not a single member of the U.S. Congress asked him about it. Nobody wanted to talk about it. I think because it was kind of over their heads. You get into this murky stuff, and nobody wants to touch this Lebanon mess anyways. I picked up on it because I knew exactly what he meant. So I think it did help the coverage in that sense. Also, a lot of the stuff that they really wanted off the record was more personal stuff. I hate that SOB, my boss. And actually, there was a lot of consternation on my last trip to Iraq. People would say, you know, I said something to you 2 years ago when I called, like, my boss a stupid mofo. Are you going to use that? And I said, yeah. They said, but at the time, I thought he would have been fired by now. There was some worry more on the other side of the table about some of the material in the book. The general who said to me, General Fastabed said to me, I never realized how profane I was until I read every quote in the book.
You are an expert on Iraq, and you know you've lived there, interviewed generals and so forth. But as you come back and realize the extent to that most people know about Iraq, the poll describing optimism today, for example, the National Museum in Baghdad reopened, and this has become a very symbolic event, an important event for Iraqis and for Americans who want to see progress in Iraq. How important are these symbols of Iraqi a nationhood, you know, the museum and so forth, to Iraqis and, for that matter, to Americans? Should it be important to Americans that, for example, the museum has reopened?
First of all, I'm not an expert on Iraq. I don't speak Arabic. I'm an expert on the U.S. military. And this is a book about the U.S. military in Iraq. It is not a book about Iraq in that sense. I think symbols are fine as long as they're understood in context. For example, you need to know what Iraqis are thinking about what you're doing. You can't just assume that that's good. For example, you can't assume that holding an election is a good thing. Also, holding an election is not the same thing as having a democracy. Democracy is rule of law, people being treated equally, public officials having respect for individual civilians. It's a lot more than simply people going down and voting one day. This whole understanding, you've got to understand the symbols, was really brought home to me one day. In 06, I was having lunch with an Iraqi general, brigadier general, in this nasty little town, Makhmadiyah, south of Baghdad. It was then known as the Triangle of Death. And we're sitting there having our very good kebabs, and there's a big bang right outside, just like in the street outside, 20 feet out. And I was curious if it was a mortar I wanted to move, because mortars tend to land in the same spot. If it was a rocket, rockets are kind of random, so I thought, well, we can finish our lunch. And I said, well, was that a rocket or a mortar? And the American advisor said, no, it was the losing contractor. They were building the school next door, and the Americans had let the contract to the lowest bidder. Well, the lowest bidder was a Sunni chieftain, and we were in a Shiite neighborhood. And the people didn't want him, and so the Shiites were shooting these things in. People have built schools again and again and burned them down, sometimes the same people, because they knew the Americans would pay them to build another school. So you've got to be careful about what you hold out as your symbols of strength, the peace of success. The museum very well might be. There's a lot of respect in Iraq, a lot of need for dignity and for people feeling that they have some standing in the world. One day, Petraeus and I were talking, and he started talking about Iraqis feeling disrespected, disregarded, and I think dispossessed. And I said, boy, that sounds like an old blues song or something. And he said, yes, as a matter of fact. And he started singing Aretha Franklin. He said, what these Iraqis want is R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
Speaking of which, a question from our audience. What do you think the military in the United States needs to do to create a space for Iraq politics to work? In your book, In the Gamble, you talk about the divide between Shia and Sunni, and how, you mentioned this earlier, how without the U.S., there wouldn't be the cohesive peace, really, that there is right now.
Well, I don't think there is a cohesive peace. I think there's a comprehensive temporary ceasefire. What do you need to create a space? What I actually think the smart money inside the U.S. national security establishment thinks is you need a generation. You need a new generation of Iraqi political leaders to emerge. And that's what they're hoping for from these provincial elections and district elections, that these new leaders emerge who take power, exercise it more prudently in a less sectarian fashion, and help fashion a new Iraq. Well, keep your fingers crossed. Yeah, might happen. You know, the Detroit Lions might win the Super Bowl next year.
Well, there are lots of people who have opinions about Iraq and Afghanistan, including people who've left office recently. Dick Cheney, for example, gave an interview recently, and this is from an audience question, that history will judge the actions in Iraq. And it seems that, you know, it's only been a short time, really, that the Obama has been in office. But really, is it much too early to judge the Bush administration's, actions in Iraq?
I don't think it's too early. I think clearly more nuance will emerge in our understanding of what happened and why. For example, one thing that really surprised me in writing this book is I really came to have an admiration for the actions George Bush took in November, December of 06 and January of 07. Now, he needed the two before of the midterm elections in 06 slammed over his head to start doing the right thing, but he really did. And I think it was actually George Bush's finest moment when he says, you know, I'm losing this war, I'm losing the American people, they ain't buying what I'm selling. And he goes out and gets himself a whole new set of commanders in Iraq, a whole new strategy, turns the war over to the dissidents and says, you know, you guys are so smart, you do it. And he backs them up. Nobody was supporting this. Nobody in the military chain of command liked the idea except Odierno. Nobody in Congress particularly liked it. But these guys were willing to take a risk, and he did take a risk. It actually struck me rereading his surge speech, January 10th, 2007, that he gave a speech that reminded me of the fireside speech that FDR gave in February 1942, saying, look, we're getting our butts kicked here. We're going to try things differently. We'll succeed. Of course, the difference was FDR gives that speech 3 months after Pearl Harbor, 3 months into the war. It takes George Bush 4.5 years before he does the right thing, before he wakes up and says, okay, let's actually change the way we're operating this war. I think history is actually going to judge these people worse than they are being judged now. I think George Bush ultimately will go down as, by far and away, the worst president this country ever had. But worse than that, I actually think we still don't know the whole story of torture. And I'm a one-issue voter on this. I really hate the idea of Americans torturing people. And torture, we all need to understand, torture was done in my name and in your name in recent years. People were subjected to extreme violations of their rights. People were killed. And we still don't know how it happened, who ordered it, how it played out. I would like to see a Truth and Reconciliation Commission akin to what South Africa had after apartheid. I'm not particularly interested in punishing the frontline guy. I don't like what happened at Abu Ghraib, which is let's beat up a bunch of privates about this. I actually, and I say this with some trepidation, I don't blame the Marines who shot 24 civilians at Haditha and massacred 24 civilians. I blame the people who put them in that position, the people who didn't train them, the people who didn't discipline them, the people who didn't guide them, which is their chain of command. Likewise, on torture, I want to know who gave the orders. How was it carried out? I'd like to see an amnesty declared. Everybody needs to come forward by a date certain and tell us what you did and how it happened. And if you do not come forward after a date certain, you are going to be subject to prosecution. Because I think we all need to know what happened, not only because it was done in our names, but maybe to prevent it from ever happening again. You cannot win a war for your values by undermining your values.
A reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Thomas Ricks, special correspondent for The Washington Post and author of The Gamble. You mentioned the Bush administration and Dick Cheney. In The Gamble and Fiasco, you are very much involved with military commanders who've been appointed by the White House, by Bush. And I'm wondering if off the record you got any of their regrets that they had, not only about the war in Iraq, but about the handling of the war. And I know you did, but can you talk about that, about this position you're in, where in a way you're closer to the generals than Bush is. I mean, he would go to Iraq unannounced in the middle of the night, but you and other people are there, and you're getting this firsthand information that probably, I imagine, would give you concern and give you pause.
Yeah, I'd known a lot of these guys for a long time. I actually was the first reporter ever to go through the Army's charm school for new brigadier generals, which was very interesting. I learned a lot. And one of the guys in my class was Raymond Odierno, a new brigadier general at the time. I've known Dave Petraeus since he was lieutenant colonel. I remember having an argument with him in Seoul, Korea once. Okay, I can't remember what about. But I remember this guy just loved a good argument. What I heard from them in these long discussions was a profound concern about the American people. Would the American people support them? Did the American people remember that they were fighting a war? Does anybody remember us back home? This is what Tom Friedman calls the 1% war. 1% of the American population is carrying the burdens of this war. 99% of us have just gone shopping until our credit cards got taken back. And when I say 1%, I mean the soldiers, but I mean even more their families. And this is not just patriotic slobber. This is really true, folks. The families carry a greater burden than the deployed soldier. I know from personal experience, it's harder on my wife when I'm in Iraq than it is on me being there. And this came home to me once when I was in a kindergarten near Fort Campbell, Kentucky, home of the 101st Airborne Division and also the Army's Special Operations Aviators. And I was talking to a kindergarten teacher at this school near the base in which the majority of kids in her class had one or more parents deployed to Iraq at the time. And she said, you know what really came home to me is one day a kid comes running into the classroom, the kindergarten. A kid comes running into the classroom and says, hey, guess what? Two Blackhawks just collided over Mosul. Imagine the burden of a 5-year-old who knows what that phrase means. And the rest of us really have been shielded, insulated from this. I think the draft has a lot of potential downsides, but, man, one thing it did was plug the American people into being concerned about what American kids were being sent to do overseas. And I would love to see that concern restored.
Wait for the applause to die down. Another question from the audience. In your book, Fiasco, you state that General Odierno had, quote, arguably failed in Iraq, although he received another star and a promotion. How do you assess his performance now? And I know that in the book, in The Gamble, Odierno really was credited for the surge, even though it was Petraeus who got a lot of the kudos.
There's no question that Odierno was one of the villains of Fiasco, and I stand by that portrayal, because it wasn't just me. It was the Army Inspector General's report, a report by an intelligence expert, retired Army Colonel Stuart Harrington. It was complaints filed by other officers. It was an interview with the MP, commander of an MP battalion attached to his division. That said, Odierno was one of the heroes of the gamble, no question. He was the only general who supported the surge inside the military. Inside the chain of command. Petraeus supported it, but had not yet been appointed to the job. The Moby Dick for me of this story was trying to figure out what happened with Odierno, and I didn't succeed. I chased that white whale for a long time, and he's a big guy. One day I turned to him in Baghdad. We would talk a lot at night. He was actually really surprisingly candid with me, I think more than Petraeus was. Partly because I think he thought, despite my harshness with him in Fiasco, I tried to be fair. When I'd asked to interview him, he scheduled it, and then he was told by Rumsfeld's office to cancel it. He canceled it. I said, okay, fine, fella, and I emailed him the chapter about him. Speak now, forever hold your peace. Well, he came zooming over to my office. So one day I'm sitting there in Baghdad, and I say, General Odierno, I'm having a hard time understanding how you got from the guy I saw in 03-04 to the commander I see now. Typical of Odierno, he looked at me and said, Tom, your problem, not mine. So, Tom's theory. Number one, his son was an Army officer in Baghdad and was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade that clipped off his left arm and killed the soldier next to him. I think that has a devastating effect on any parent, but especially one who's a commander in Iraq. Second, After his first tour in Iraq, he had one of the more interesting jobs in the military. He was essentially the Pentagon's ambassador to the State Department, and he traveled with the Secretary of Defense. And I think he learned a lot about the rest of the government, where the levers of power were, but he learned especially that the rest of the government did not share the general's rosy assessment of the war in Iraq, that CIA and State and National Security Council thought this thing was going down in flames, no matter what the assurances the generals were giving. So I think that was a real eye-opener to him. And third, and most importantly, he gets back to Iraq in late 06, and General Casey says, well, we're going to continue with the strategy. Nobody here knows says, wait, you're leaving, and you're ordering me to continue a losing strategy. I don't want to lose this thing on my watch. And I actually reprint this in the appendices of the book, the orders given to him in December 06 by General Casey. You will move your troops out of the cities. You will secure the lines of communication. You will seal the borders and essentially let these people hold the civil war they seem to want to have. Odierno rewrites this, and when Petraeus arrives in February 07, Odierno says, this is what I want to do. I want to move into the cities. I want to protect the Iraqi people, and I want to drop transition to Iraqis as a top priority. I want to protect the people. And Odierno says, let's do it, and let's do this counterinsurgency stuff, and off they go.
One of the things in your book is one of the details is that the generals in Iraq essentially ignored the Bush administration and put a lot of insurgents on the payroll. And this is a moment that you've talked about before, but I'd love to hear what your thoughts on this again, and how ironic it was that these former insurgents were actually now getting taxpayer money.
This was actually one of the biggest surprises to me in my interviews with Petraeus. I said to him one day, actually, it was in October, I said, I'm curious about a moment I've never heard anybody talk about. It hasn't come up. How did you sell President Bush on the notion of putting the enemy on the American payroll? He said, I didn't. And I said, well, you sought his approval. No. And I said, General, this is the biggest policy change in the war in the last couple of years, and you didn't bother to mention it to the president? And he said, well, we did eventually, but nobody thought it was going to be 100,000 guys at $30 million a month. So actually, he didn't so much ignore the president. I think this was the counterinsurgency equivalent of don't ask, don't tell.
Last time you were here at the Commonwealth Club, you said you were reading Greek tragedy to understand Iraq. Have changes on the ground made you more optimistic? And what are you reading now? This is a question from the audience.
It's funny you should ask that, actually. I've been obsessing on Roman history. And part of this is one of the few benefits of reporting in Iraq is you can either fly through London or fly through Rome. And I figured I'd fly through Rome. And so on every trip over the last couple of years, I'd stop in Rome either on the way over or the way back and just chill out for a few days in the world's most civilized city. Or else I'd go walking in Tuscany or something like that. I found myself sitting last October, actually, in the Forum. And it was an odd week because it was a week in which the Americans had gotten an airstrike in Syria. We were fighting in Iraq, obviously. We had done a series of airstrikes in Pakistan, and we were fighting in Iraq and maybe have something going on in Iran. So here we were fighting in a series of Middle Eastern states from the Mediterranean to the Indian Ocean. I'm sitting there looking at the Forum, and I realize there are two arches still extant in the Roman Forum. One is the Arch of Titus at the eastern or southern end. The other is the Arch of Septimius Severus, I guess it's pronounced, at the other end. They're both about the Middle East. It's not about Germany, France. One is about, I think, the conquest of Jerusalem in AD 69, AD 70. And the other one is about Mesopotamia. And I thought to myself, man, we seem to be like them, kind of stuck out there. They walked into it, they thought they could change it, and instead they just got stuck there. So I've been reading tons of Roman history, which I find just fascinating. I don't think history repeats itself. I do think history rhymes. And I'm struck also, actually, oddly enough, in the middle of Tacitus, I find that in AD, I think it was 35, the Romans had a financial crisis. Huge deflation. They had to reset interest rates to zero for 3 years. And it only ended when the Roman equivalent of the Fed injected a huge amount of money into the system. Literally, the emperor had to put in 100 million or whatever they're called, sesterces, into the system. So people have been there before. And meanwhile, the Romans were also mucking around in the Middle East.
The question about what you're reading now, you've actually written a lot of books, but one of them is a novel called A Soldier's Story.
Soldier's Duty.
Soldier's Duty, excuse me. Yeah. And it came out in the months before 9/11. And this novel is actually about Afghanistan and about conundrums in Afghanistan. Now, I've seen reviews of the book, and they credit you not only for writing a good book, very well written, but in some ways, not predicting what was going to happen in Afghanistan, but really being prescient in that way. I'm wondering, first of all, what prompted you to write a novel? And secondly, is this one of these things that actually you do in your leisure, taking your time away from, the events in war and military?
I love to write. Some people have to run 5 miles a day or something. I really need 5,000 words a day, or at least 1,000 words a day, to come out of my fingers. I mean, I just like to write. And I was interested to try on novel writing, partly because it makes you see the world differently. I've never told her this, but Anne Lamott, a local writer here, I think that's from the Mill Valley area, was actually the inspiration for A Soldier's Duty. I think she'd be horrified, this war novel. But I just found her really inspiring in the way she talked about how to think about character and conflict and structure. And I really, for her book Bird by Bird, which is a great guide to writing for anybody who's writing fiction or nonfiction, and I was very much influenced by it. And I said, okay, let's try my hand at this and write this novel. Nobody ever read it, except a few reviewers. In fact, my daughter took me aside after the book came out and said, Dad, next book, nonfiction. One other thing I am reading, by the way, is Kipling, who I think is a bad rap. Kipling's very interesting. We're not as sophisticated in our understanding of the Asia and the subcontinent as Kipling was. The two things that I've been rattling in my head recently was one is he's got a terrific short story called The Head of the District, which you can find online. Starts slowly, gets really good. It's about pitting Islamic extremism against tribal structures, which we think is so new and sophisticated. It's also a pun on who's the head of the district, but also about decapitation, not a new thing either. The other thing is, and I can't remember which Kipling poem it is, but it has the refrain in the middle, "Here lies a fool who tried to hustle the East." And I hope that Richard Holbrook reads that every night before he goes to bed.
A reminder to our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Thomas Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of The Gamble. We're down to a couple last minutes here. One question we have from the audience, so the search failed, how would you have conducted it? And I don't know whether this is a fair question or not, but I'd love to hear your answer.
They don't have to be fair. they have to be good. No, but fair isn't part of the issue. It's not even for me as a reporter. It's just good questions. It is a good question. I think the surge was done extremely well, about as well as you could do it. But this takes me back to the notion of original sin. It was the least bad answer in a misbegotten war. Nothing good really could come of it. So you're stuck, and you do with the best you can. It's a really un-American answer. Americans like solutions. And I'm telling you, there is no solution. You can't undo what's been done. We're stuck. There we are. And there are no good answers. And I really think they are all immoral. And there's blood on our hands.
A lot of reporters who go to Iraq end up getting so involved in what's happening there that they become physically affected by what they see. And I'm wondering, you've been to Iraq many times. How have you been affected in ways perhaps that surprised you even before you went there? And, did you have second thoughts ever about being in Iraq for as long as you have?
Yeah, every day. I had a couple of advantages. I knew a lot of people in the military. It was not an alien world to me. I gave myself a treat once in February 06. I said, I want to go all around Iraq and see different operations. But I am so sick of fighting with people in the military. I'm only going to visit commanders I know and like. Because it just saves so much time and energy. I remember showing up at one squadron commander's headquarters. And it was a regimental commander's headquarters. And I walked into the headquarters. And normally it's like, oh, reporter on deck, everybody watch out. And they said, oh, your seat's down there in the intel section. Okay. And, you know, and there's a little scene, that's just as long as Tom's here, that's where he sits and works. I was in the middle of these intel guys. We ended up arguing the whole time about, you know, Iraqi history in the 1920s and stuff. Actually, Joel Rayburn, who was the intel officer there, Major Joel Rayburn, and I went down to downtown Tulloch Farm. We're standing up on the Citadel Wall and saying, okay, now here's where the British were ambushed in 1920. And the soldier yells up to us, get off the wall. You guys are skylighted for the whole city. But we were like busy doing history. I think anybody who's been in a place like Iraq, which is an extremely harsh and difficult climate, where there is no rare area, there's no place you feel safe, anybody is going to be affected by it. I have a friend who was a reporter who I think did not do herself any good. She would get up every day and say, today's the day I might die. I had a somewhat less dramatic version of that. As we live out in the post when I'm there. We have a house out in Baghdad. It's in a neighborhood. It's not in the green zone. It's a big myth all the reporters live in the green zone. We lived in what the U.S. military calls the red zone, which is the rest of Iraq. And we had a nice house. And I would say to myself as I went out the front gate every morning, have I done everything I can to minimize the risk to myself? Basically, the question, can I die with a clear conscience if I get killed today? And after Fiasco came out, my wife asked me not to go back to Iraq anymore. And for a year, I agreed. And then I said, look, I really need to go back. I was born to cover this. Somebody later pointed out that's what Bernard Fall said before he went back to Vietnam and got killed. But I said, I really need to go back. But we actually formulated a new set of rules. And under the ceasefire agreement with my wife, no more combat patrols, no more convoys. And the biggest single change was I used to only take the risk I deemed necessary to get the story I was pursuing. The new formulation, much more restrictive, was you will not take any risk that you perceive, even if it means losing the story. That said, I'm not planning on going back to Iraq. I expect to write the third volume of this trilogy when the war ends, but I think I've got 7 to 15 years before I do that. So my next book actually is going to be History of American Generalship, World War II to the Present, looking at our different concept of generalship and why we've lost the concept of accountability in battlefield command.
Well, our thanks to Thomas Ricks, military correspondent for the Washington Post, author of Fiasco and The Gamble, General Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006-2008. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.